Welcome to Hydrofeminist Meditations, a listening series brought to you by Ensayos. Ensayos is a collective research practice born 10 years ago in Tierra del Fuego, at the southernmost tip of South America. Our work is dedicated to understanding the ecopolitics of archipelagos. We ask ethical questions inspired by the places we love. We ally with scientists and communities in the work of conserving and caring for precarious ecosystems. What we do is bring art and environmental humanities into the process of conservation. I'm your host, Catalina Jaramillo. Episode 1, Eastern Australia. In this episode, we will follow the migration path of the mysterious short-fin eel. Like freshwater eels returning to sea, we'll begin this episode inland at the urban Mary Mary Creek. Then, we'll continue thousands of miles north to the eel's breeding grounds in the Coral Sea. We will encounter many small creatures along the way, some of which you may never have seen or heard of before. In Australia, public events begin with an acknowledgement of country and elders. This is a way for guests to show respect for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander histories and their ongoing relationships with lands and waters. A good start is to learn local Indigenous language for greetings, place names, and animals. This is why you will hear Indigenous place names used throughout this episode. Before we begin, take a moment to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land where you are now. Act 1. We begin in Narm, also known as Melbourne, Australia. Educator and artist Sarita Galvez and her sons, Sam and Nahuel, will introduce us to the Mary Mary Creek and the ethics of care that drives the environmental education program called Creeklum. Creeklum connects the community of Moreland Primary School with the Mary Mary by foregrounding the vast richness of Wurundjeri knowledge and ways of living. The program also brings artists and scientists to the school and the creek to work with students. Creeklum is informed by radical Latin American pedagogies and provides an anti-colonial alternative to the systemic racism of settler education in Australia. Sarita developed Creeklum with Wurundjeri Tribe Land Council, Scale Free Network, Mary Creek Management Committee, educator Meg Petrie, weaver Adrian Kneebone, Slow Art Collective, and Moreland Primary School. Wurundjeri elders Uncle Dave Wanding and Uncle Bill Nicholson gave Sarita and her sons permission to share cultural knowledge. Sarita Galvez takes it from here.
Eyes, I see,
permiso pido esta agua a la anguila de aleta corta. Permiso pido esta agua y a la anguila aleta corta que esta historia, que este cuento les traiga prosperidad en la reciprocidad de este canto yo prometo que las prácticas de cuidado sean siempre veneradas.
I'm just arriving to the Mary Mary, and it's a cold morning, it's a bit grey, and the quiet waters of the creek just next to me. And I just observed two tiny frog mouth perching on a branch. I'm gonna start by saying hi to the waters and by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on where I'm standing.
So firstly, we would like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation, who have taken care of this land, its waters and its ecosystem for thousands of years.
I'd like to pay my respects to the elders, past, present and emerging, to their families and to their children. The sovereignty of this land has never been ceded. Not the sovereignty of the knowledges that have sustained these lands and these waterways.
And we would also like to give our respects to any elders who are listening or tuning in to this podcast.
And acknowledge all First Nations peoples of the continent of Australia and in the world.
As an uninvited guest to this land, coming from Chile 8 years ago, I feel welcome. One of the ways that I practice care deeply as a mother of two children growing up in these lands is a pedagogical program with other parents of our kids. And we did lots of big, long walks with the kids from school. And what I'm walking just now is probably what I could call the curriculum grounds when we did most of our little experiments and wanderings and wanderings. The key force that moved the curriculum was learning from traditional custodians about the practice of caring for country. And we did it by experimenting with an ecology of knowledges that came together in the forms of radical science and microscopes to see the life of two drops of waters of the Mary Mary. And the children were marveled to see there was so much life in two drops of water. Life that we cannot see, but we can feel.
Oh my God, look at his claws against the...
He's upside down.
Here.
Oh my God.
Everything's alive in its own sense.
Like they said that soil, it isn't alive, but there are things that are alive in it. But soil's actually really alive.
It's a big symbiosis of plants, animals, of everything.
It's just like so many little pieces of atoms form such a big, beautiful thing.
Making blurry those distinctions of what is alive and what is not a distinction that became even blurred where they were experiencing the stories of creation told by the traditional custodians, Wurundjeri elders of the area. How the creek came into being, how the creek connected to the Birung River. How do we care for country with fire and song and dance? And how caring for country is a responsibility of settlers as well as of indigenous peoples to the land. The ethics of being responsible.
I see. I sing. I sing.
One of the important lessons that we learned with Uncle Dave Wandin was about fire and land management, and how fire is medicine for keeping ecosystems healthy. And it's a very specific kind of fire that Uncle Dave explained to us, which are called cool burning, also known as mosaic fires. There are, do you remember, kids, how he described
it? Was not allowed that they would burn the trees. They would only burn the grass, and it was not so tall, and they could like walk.
And it was also a kind of fire that is done slow, but it's also done in patches. So that means that it's lines of fire, but within patches that are not being burnt. So that means that that's the place that animals and insects can find straightaway refuge. And what he said is really important is that it's a kind of fire that is done seasonally. So you need the very right conditions to do this kind of burning, when enough mist and moist in the air, so that the fires can be done safely. As we experienced the bushfires in Australia in December and January 2020 in New South Wales, it made us think a lot about the learnings with Uncle Dave. Because if land is managed correctly, fires like that shouldn't happen. So bushfires are also connected to the colonial land management in Australia.
I see.
We are connected. The eels bring us together in a sense of migration, movement, swimming, going upstream and downstream, changing our bodies and shapes as we go along.
Act 2. Moving north to the Yugambeh region of Australia's Gold Coast, we arrive at the creeks and eucalypt forest of Guanaba Indigenous Protected Area. This is the setting for a story by Dr. C.F. Black, known as Christine to her Ensayos collaborators. Guanaba is part of the traditional lands of Christine's matrilineal clan, the Kombu Meri. Because of its steep slope, Guanaba has been less impacted by timber harvesting, cattle grazing, and bushfires than elsewhere in the region. It is an important habitat for rarely seen small marsupials called potoroos, numbats, and quolls. Their survival remains under threat from feral cats, wild dogs, and encroaching human settlement. Christine is an Indigenous legal scholar and an intellectual explorer. She writes about international Indigenous mythologies and legal understandings. Here, she will share the first four parts of a much longer story. It is titled The Bringers of the Viral Red Dust. The story was written in 2009, the year of the H1N1 pandemic, and a massive red dust storm that covered Australia's east coast. During that time, a small band of potteroos was discovered in Wanaba. In the story that follows, dust has a consciousness and personality, and a virus moves through the land without regard for human actions. We begin with the story of old.
The old, clever people had kept watch over the doorway since ancient times. They say that when the earth was still yawning and making up its mind as to how it wanted to feel, there were two brave dogs that lived in the land, now known as Bow Desert. They ran and hunted with the great hunter from the south. Then came the day when the old hunter was not paying attention and those dogs got eaten by those lazy boys. And that's when all the bad things started to happen. Little did they know that through their selfish acts, they had brought into being the great hounds. The gateway had been opened by the willful act of killing the hunting dogs. The people did not know that the dogs were law dogs, magic dogs that guarded the gateway. But now it was laid to waste, and through the gateway came the hounds. So quiet they were. No one heard the hounds come through, nor did they see them slip into that cave. There they waited for the evening dew to refresh the nocturnal brothers and sisters of the land as they scurried and hopped across the starlit terrain. Unbeknown to them, the great hounds were watching them and planning. And as time stretched out and the land settled into its present pattern, the hounds grew mightier. And as they grew, they gathered the red dust around them until they became so large that their dust storms were a mile high and miles wide. To all the little beings of the land, they became known as the dreaded bringers of the red dust.
The koala's tail.
Big as ponies,
said Collie the koala as she sat high in the gum tree.
The red dust is so thick you can barely see. They are known as the bringers of the viral red dust.
Collie's eyes widened when she said those words, for such words were full of power, destructive power, that sent shivers down the spines of all the koalas listening to Collie. She and her family had seen them on the outer reaches of the dense scrub, where the Aboriginal dreaming paths cross. Collie didn't believe her eyes at first, but after Captain Koala saw them and little Pengana took fright and turned into a sparrowhawk to get away, Collie knew they were real.
Real as you and me.
Collie snuggled down into her little branch. Her large backside hung over the edges.
But Burbie knows better than me. I've only seen them, and that was enough for me,
she said as she shivered once more, which in turn made the whole group shiver. The koalas then turned their heads up to Burbie.
They roamed the lands with no natural predators. Instead, they fought amongst themselves and eventually formed two large packs, the hounds of the north and the hounds of the west. These hounds devastated all the lands on which they fought, bringing with them disease and destruction, like tsunami waves of dust surging from an inland sea of ancient times. These ancient beings would kill anyone who got in their way,
said Burby sadly as she glazed over in horror at what she had seen. For this scene was the future which was coming towards the little community of nocturnal animals that lived in the beautiful valley of Guanabara. Over the generations, the koala bears, and especially those known as the wind watchers, like Burby, kept up a surveillance of the hounds and their ongoing fights. They telepathically transmitted to other koalas across the land the movement of the hounds, so had given everyone time to either burrow or get out of the way or disappear in other ways that suited their constitution. It was only the small marsupials that were most likely to survive. And one of those little tribes was that of the potoroos of Guanabara, small little bundles of grey fluff with long snouts and little paws, which they held out in front of them as they hopped around the undergrowth. The last of the tribe. Deep in the dense undergrowth of the bushlands of Guanabara, the last potoroo tribe was hiding out for fear of being run down by the great hounds of the north. The potoroos had originally been in many places across Australia, but as time went by and the hounds roamed the land, the potoroos had been whittled down to just a few dozen hiding out in Guanabara. Their small number had therefore made them susceptible to the koala stories, and the thought of their pending death by the great hounds had nearly driven the community mad. They therefore gladly welcomed a small pack of quolls, whose tribe had died of asphyxiation when the hounds of the west had run them down. Quolls are much larger than potoroos, with their spotted coats and their long tails. The Chant of Charlie Numbat. But that was just one story that was crossing the land. There was another story which was making its mark on the landscape. The bearer of the story was Charlie Numbat. He was an excitable character, especially when he had news. His rich brown eyes would flash and his perky little ears twitch. His long tail would swish back and forth over his furry back that had the most striking black and white bands across it. The Numbat was a great traveller and had come far across the land from the home of the westerly winds. He travelled the land and gathered news of the humans and the hounds. Charlie had felt it was his moral duty to snoop out the news and spread it to one and all. And so Charlie hopped into the little community of marsupials in Guanabara. Charlie hopped onto a log and called to one and all to listen. The first to come forward were the little potoroos. They hurried out of their burrows, rubbing their little paws in anticipation of the news from Charlie. Then came the large spotted quolls from behind the ridges. They kept their distance as they were a suspicious lot. Charlie began in his quick, lively voice to tell his tale.
I've come with important news. The humans are warning of a coming of a pandemic. They are saying it's spread by the bats. But I'm sure there is more involved, and that the bats are innocent. When their hiding places had been destroyed by the humans, they came down to the human level. This had made them targets for all that human silliness. I warn you, be ready for a pandemic. Humans, bats, and birds are dying. The pandemic is spreading. And worst of all, the dead could actually fall into your little hiding place here in Guanabara.
Having successfully frightened the living daylights out of the audience, Charlie further puffed up his chest and deepened his voice, so he sounded very authoritative.
Of course, if you ask me, I believe the source of the pandemic was the horse stud down in the lowlands of Bow Desert.
All the marsupials were aghast to think such a thing was so near.
So those koalas better be careful,
said Charlie as he looked up into the trees to see if the koalas had come to hear him speak. but to his disappointment, none were to be seen.
"Well, I must be off to warn others,"
cried Charlie as he jumped down from the log and quickly disappeared into the underbrush, leaving his audience stunned.
In this act, you're invited to sit with us in a majestic mangrove tree on Canaipa Island in Cuandamuca country. Here, we soak up the sounds of the salt marsh and respond with our voices. This practice is inspired by the composer Pauline Oliveros' pursuit of sonic meditation through deep listening. You can listen to this piece in two ways. To actively participate, take a deep breath and listen. With your next breath, exhale a new sound, one that is not in the mix. Continue alternating between matching and creating new sounds with each breath. Or you can simply listen and bathe in the mangrove tuning. Here we go.
Oh,
Act 4. We now move further north, up the eastern Australian coastline, following the euk, the short-finned eel, to its breeding grounds in the Coral Sea. Ensayistas spend time on Jambanan, also known as Magnetic Island, with Dr. Lynn van Heverden. She's a marine biologist who studies the impact of microplastics on the marine food web in the Great Barrier Reef. The copepod, a microscopic zooplankton, is in grave danger. Life in the ocean depends on its survival. More than anything, Lynn wants everyone to know and care about this. She handed us a copy of her findings and asked us how artists might be intermediaries. We closely read her research papers, visited her laboratory, and interviewed her to get to the heart of the message. The weight and complexity of the issues were difficult to navigate. With dark humor and playful curiosity, we turned the research into the copepod song. Sarita and her family rehearse it at the end of this segment. But first, let's hear what Dr. Lynn has to say.
And swallowed a parvocalinus crassirostris.
I liked the. I don't even know what microplastics are, but I die. Because then you can go to the parts of the parts.
I swallowed some plastic. I don't know what microplastics are. I hope I don't die.
Microplastics? What sort of size are we talking about?
Microplastics are anything smaller than 0.5 of a millimeter all the way down to nanoparticles where they are totally invisible to the eye.
Do you have microplastics in your body?
We don't dissect human guts to see if we've got microplastics in our guts, but what we can do is we can grab our poo, and both copepods and humans and probably coral trout, they all have microplastics in their poo. Not that I've seen anyone publish a study about poo containing microplastics from coral trout, but certainly from humans and from copepods we know that's the case.
Who feeds on coral trout?
Coral trout are really valued in the fisheries, and it's the largest export from the Barrier Reef.
Who's the coral trout?
Coral trout are larger fish that are ambush predators most of the time. They like to hang under coral bommies. They're beautifully coloured. They have these luminescent, almost phosphorescent blue spots all over their body, depending on the species. But they basically feed on other smaller things in the ocean, particularly anything that they can fit their mouth around. Coral trout as adults wouldn't be feeding on the plankton and wouldn't be eating microplastics directly. But the first thing coral trout larvae eat is copepod larvae, and they love eating copepods, which accidentally eat plastic. So we know that coral trout are getting those plastics in through the food that they eat in the food web.
Copepods. Can you say more about copepods?
Copepods are on the smaller side of the spectrum of organisms that live in the plankton. They have little appendages, and they have carapace, and they have little eye spots with which they can sense light, and they can feed by capturing the food that is the correct size for their tiny mouths in little setae that are on their appendages that they then can brush off into their mouths and feed on. So
copepods eat plastic. What is that about?
So plastic is floating in the soup of zooplankton and phytoplankton in the ocean, this nice big warm incubator. And they can be the same size as the phytoplankton cells that the zooplankton feeds on. And if that happens and they get captured by those little setae on the appendages that they feed from, then the plastics will go down the hatch along with the phytoplankton that these copepods are trying to feed on.
What is phytoplankton?
Phytoplankton are tiny single-celled plants that fill the surface waters of the ocean. Phytoplankton is really important in the marine ecosystem because they provide the first food source to the next layer in the food web, which is a tiny zooplankton.
And copepods are zooplankton.
We're all bound to die. We're all gonna die.
I think we need to just go
we're
dark.
Gonna die.
Let's try this one again.
Yeah.
I have a twist.
Okay.
I just change external things, but inside I'm still the same person. That's what epigenetics is. It's basically taking molecules and modifying the outside of the DNA in your cells so that it changes the expression and the behavior of your genes so that you respond differently to particular events that are happening to your physical being. What we have found was that if you feed copepods microplastics, they will not do well for a generation or so, and then after 3 generations they seem to start recovering and the population starts growing more again. On the other hand, if you feed copepods plasticizers are actually hormone disrupting chemicals, so if they get into the food web they mess up the hormonal pathways in the body so that normal functions don't happen, and plasticizers specifically have been linked with feminization of male gonads. So they don't produce much sperm because they're starting to produce estrogen. So not just in humans, but in all sorts of organisms this has been shown. They often lead to cancers in the reproductive tissues and result in organisms not being able to reproduce. And we saw for 3 generations after feeding the copepod adults, the plasticizer in tiny amounts, the offspring of the offspring of the offspring, were still producing a fraction of the eggs, like a 95% reduction of egg production, even though they weren't being exposed to the hormone disrupting chemical anymore.
Plastic for breakfast
instead of phytoplankton.
Just sucked it right up into its gut.
Yeah, it got stuck there.
I hope it don't die. I woke up this morning and swallowed fish larva. It's sooner on my tummy, all salty and gooey. I swallowed a fish larva that swallowed a copepod.
That swallowed a
microplastic instead of phytoplankton. I hope we don't die. Woke up this morning and swallow a damsel fish.
I wish you'd stop eating fish.
I swallow a damsel fish that swallow fish larva that swimming around my tummy on salty and gooey. I swallow fish larva that swallow a copepod that swallow microplastic instead of phytoplankton.
Reducing its chance of survival by 40%.
Are they all gonna die? I woke up this morning and swallow a I swallow a coral trout that swallow a dumpster that swallow fish larva that swim around my tummy all salty and gooey. I swallow fish larva that swallow a copepod that swallow my blood for breakfast instead
of phytoplankton.
At the base of the food web, we are all gonna die.
Thanks for joining us on this Hydrofeminist meditation. In the next episode, we'll continue to share our practices of caring for bodies and waters. Stay tuned to hear from the fjords, rivers, and ice fields of Norway. We are all bodies of water. What we do to water, we do to everybody, including ourselves.
Hydrofeminist Meditations was produced by Ensayos during a residency at the New Museum of Contemporary Art. The Australia Council for the Arts provided additional support. This episode was created by Caitlin Franzman, Sarita Galvis, and Dr. C.F. Black, with Dr. Lynn Van Herveden, Amara Rahim, Brian Phillips, Sam and Nahuel Phillips, Ariel Bustamante, Pablo Tierman, Catalina Jaramillo, Camila Marambio, and Christy Gast. Music is by Vered Vale, and We Are All Bodies of Water are the wise words of Astrida Neymanis.